I'd like to begin right where you left off with a reference to prophecy. Because I believe one of the most prophetic passages in the Bible is one that was not intended to be prophecy at all. It's a historical account. But because history repeats itself, that makes it prophecy. Solomon told us that, he says, the thing that hath been is the thing which shall be. And that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new, it hath been already of old time, which was before us. So history does repeat itself, and in that sense, history is prophecy. And the passage to which I'm referring in the Old Testament is written in Genesis 11, near the end of the account that is known as the story of the Tower of Babel. If you recall that account, the people were politically of one mind. They were politically united. They were of one language. They were able to communicate. Now, communication sometimes solves a lot of problems. There's a lot of things, a lot of problems we have we wouldn't have if we could communicate better. But communication can also get you into mischief once in a while. And that's what happened there at the Tower of Babel. King James Version describes it this way. The people said to one another, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a name. Or the Living Bible puts it this way, the people began to talk about building a great city with a temple tower reaching the skies, a proud and eternal monument to themselves. And following that comes the Lord's assessment of the situation. He said, now these people are able to communicate with one another and share knowledge. Nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. Again, as the Revised Standard puts it, this is only the beginning of what they will do, and nothing they propose to do will now be impossible for them. The Living Bible says a little bit more, but it's actually incorporating thoughts that are at the beginning of the story. And it puts it this way, if they are able to accomplish this thing when they've just begun to exploit their linguistic and political unity, just think what they're going to do later. Nothing will be unattainable for them. Now that's a kind of feeling that is much abroad today, that nothing is unattainable for man. But it's not said as in Scripture as a warning. It's said as a boast. For today the language of science is a universal language. The people speak the same tongue. And there are human engineers at work today in at least a dozen major countries. United States, Germany, Russia, France, Japan, Australia, Netherlands, Canada, Israel, Scandinavian nations, just to name a few of them. And they're working on a method by which a relatively small number of people can control larger numbers of people. Their object is to build an ideal society. But you see, immediately two questions are raised. One is, what is the standard by which you measure what is ideal? And secondly, who is able to make the decision of what is ideal? Now, on this latter question, there are quite a few volunteers who arrogantly say, yes, we can make this decision. Among these, unfortunately, are some of our most renowned and influential educators. Now at this point, let me sound a caution. And please hear me. Nothing that will be said should be thought of as an attack upon science. Discovery, experimentation, if you will, application of knowledge is part of the commission that God gave to man when he said that man should subdue the earth. They should have dominion over it. He should discover what there is about the earth and make it serve the welfare of man and make it serve the glory of God. And apart from the spiritual truth that God has revealed, I think perhaps one of his richest gifts to us is science. modern day saints. I think perhaps some of you can even testify to that personally. I know I can say that by the grace of God and in an answer to prayer and through the gifts of science, my wife's life has been spared twice. One from all outward appearances and all prognostications it would not have been. So I'm not speaking against science at all. But I would like to walk through some things with you that are possible today as a result of scientific investigation, and some things that are being done today in the area of human manipulation. Some of these things may frighten you. That's why I'm telling them to you, in order to frighten you. One of the things that can be done today is in the field of mind control, or mind bending, through various subliminal forces. For example, what can be done today is that a picture can be flashed on a television screen. While you're watching the screen, watching a drama perhaps, family life situation, whatever, that picture will be flashed there repeatedly, but so quickly that your eye doesn't perceive it. And yet the message gets through to your brain. Or a dim image, so dim that, again, the eye doesn't consciously perceive it, can be used as an overlay to the picture that you're watching. And all the while, a message is getting through to you while you're not conscious of it. Or the arrangement of objects on the television screen can be so subtly done that that arrangement suggests something to your unconscious mind, or subconscious mind, I should say, while you're not aware of it. An arrangement of objects can stimulate anger in you. It can rouse you sexually. All sorts of things. Without your being consciously aware. So in this one thing alone, consumers can be directed into buying certain products. Employers can do the same thing with films in order to stimulate their employees. Athletes can be roused to peak performance through some kind of a challenge. News viewers can have the news presented in such a way that they make decisions, and voters can be influenced to vote by certain parties without any of these people being conscious of what's happening. Now, because this can be done and has been done, practically every application of this is illegal today. But nevertheless, this is simply to call attention to what can be done. Let's go to another area, test tube babies. These are well within the realm of possibility today. But more, it is possible today to have banks in which human sperm and ova are stored so that they can be withdrawn from the bank, or if you want, purchased from a store and implanted in a human being to raise a certain baby. And if you don't particularly care about the discomfort of carrying a child, is the possibility of leasing a womb of someone else and have them carry the egg and the sperm that you have selected from the stock. This is within the realm of possibility today. There are people who have suggested, not introduced, just suggested legislation that would establish the legal beginning and end of life. We know that we have this controversy with the abortion issue, whether conception or somewhere between conception and birth, or birth legally establishes life. It has been suggested by some human engineers that the age of 1 year should be the official beginning of life, because it is not until a child is a year old that a child fully is aware of himself. And how can you have a human being without self-awareness? That's the argument that's used. But the same people concede that this would not be popularly received, so that the legal beginning of life probably would have to be established somewhere between birth and the age 1 year. And of course, we also know that there are those who suggested a legal termination of life. That's within the realm of possibility today. Then the matter of drugs. We're not talking about the street drugs, but we're talking about drugs that are produced in order to control people. They can be used to fire up armies. They can be used to stimulate athletes. They can be used to make students more willing to learn and to control behavior problems. In the great experiment that was held in 1973 and 74, spreading out from Omaha, Nebraska public schools, but involving over a million people, children in the United States, children were given drugs that some of them were on the order of the street drugs almost. Some of them had been recommended by the FDA not to be given to anyone under 12 years of age, but nevertheless were given in an attempt to correct behavior problems by the use of drugs. And the reports that came in were quite satisfactory from parents and educators. I'm not saying there aren't individual cases. I know of some individual cases where this is necessary in hypertensive young people to enable them to learn under a doctor's prescription, but this was a wholesale experiment, and it was finally a public outcry that brought it to a halt. But there seems to be almost unlimited possibilities of what can be done with drugs. Now, you can add to that the possibilities of brain operations to alter behavior, sleep teaching, which is can be a very beneficial thing. But if somebody else decides to do the teaching on your sleep time, it could also have a bad effect. Hypnosis, again, which has very legitimate medical applications, post-hypnotic suggestion, but can be demonstrated to have also very bad effects. Another possibility is the implantation of electrodes. That can be done today. An electrode placed beneath the skin that will either provide surveillance to the one who is monitoring the signal it sends out, or it can be used to stimulate pain or pleasure centers as rewards or punishments for behavior. It is not impossible that a whole society could be controlled by such electrodes placed under their skin or locked on a wrist or ankle, with only the government able to remove them. And just have a nation of sheep all at the command of someone who's pushing buttons. This is within the possibility today. It can be done today. So these are the immediate things, just a few of them. There are many more. If you are interested in that subject, Vance Packard's People Shapers has a lot of it. Some things that we soon shall be able to do. One is to build human beings to order, not using just one sperm and one ova, but genetically altered sperm and ova that could combine the qualities of four parents, so that the test tube baby then would really have four parents. It is within the possibility in the near future of producing a subhuman species of people. By controlling the oxygen to the fetus before birth, giving them such a low mentality and devoid of feelings, emotions, so that they are content just to eat and sleep, rest and eat, that's all. They have no interest beyond this. Where you could breed a particular class of people for menial labor. In 1984, in the novel, this was done for the sewer workers. They really had no emotions about working in the sewer. They didn't care as long as they were fed. But this is well within the realm of possibility today, or even more so, raising totally mindful people. Functional, healthy vegetables that could be kept in a compound for spare parts, for organ transplants. Another possibility is transplanting memory particles. There's a lot of experimentation going on with that somewhere in the body, either in the genetic makeup, in the brain, somewhere, some say in every cell of the human body, there is a memory particle in which memories are stored. Now, if these memory particles could be removed and placed in a genetic chain, it might be possible to transplant the memory of one person into a fetus so that he grows up with all the knowledge that the parent had, see? So just imagine if you had a sample of Einstein's tissue, you would have a child growing up with all of Einstein's knowledge already. That would be his starting point to go on from there. There's much experimentation along this line, and nothing has been really develop, but it's within the realm of possibility. It's no more fantastic than a lot of things that have happened in our lives that we take for granted now. It's no more fantastic than television was a century ago. And the fact that scientists are thinking in terms of these memory particles suggests the possibility that this is where these previous lives come from. That perhaps it is possible to have genetic memory. The genes can, I'm talking seriously now, the genes perhaps can carry memory traces. So that what a person who is recalling a previous life is doing is not really recalling a previous incarnation at all, but is stimulating something that brings out that memory that was passed on genetically and is remembering somebody else's life, not their own, some forebearer of theirs. And there's quite a bit of experimentation going on in this whole field of genetic memory. So there may be a very ordinary explanation to such things as Bridie Murphy and all the others that have followed since. Maybe a very ordinary thing for all we know. I mentioned about leased wombs. Also, the possibility of simply building artificial wombs in which to raise your purchased sperm and ovum. Or using animal wombs. That the animal serves as a surrogate mother for the sperm and ovum that you chose. Possibility of marrying man and animal. Using marrying in a broad sense of transplanting organs from animals into men, organs that are believed to function in a superior way to man's organs. And there has been some experimenting done with live human fetuses that were aborted. Very small, very early fetuses that were aborted, where some of these tiny organs taken from the fetus have been kept alive in the body of mice. So the conclusion is that perhaps the other way around would work too, but of course there are legal restrictions that does not permit this kind of performance on a fetus, on a human fetus. The marrying of man and the machine, the $6 million man, is no longer fantastic. But we seem to be nearing the brink of when this thing can happen, where man's brain can be tied to a computer or to an artificial limb that's given super strength because the brain operates by electrical signals. Now, if those signals can be tapped, they could be fed directly to the computer or directly to the artificial limb and cause it to act. Right now the problem is still threefold. One is determining just what kind of signal that electrical signal is. Secondly, knowing being able to amplify it enough to make it work. And then third, knowing just where to tap into the system, into the brain to get the proper signal. But it seems to be a foregone conclusion that this thing will be coming. Well, enough of that kind of thing. I'm only mentioning the possibilities. Practically all of these in specific applications would be beneficial to man. I think even the artificial woman thought, or the test tube baby, these things can be beneficial in specific applications. But we always have to look both ways, also at the abuses that are possible, and whether those abuses will outweigh the good or not. The rationale of human engineering is sound, namely that we face crises of energy, crises of food supply, crises of space to live in, and man must develop some techniques if he's going to survive in this life. So that is right. But for many who are engaged in human engineering, man himself is the only key. In other words, man alone is the captain of his fate. Man must determine his own future, and he can do this only by genetic engineering and by controlling environment. So now you get into this whole battle of which is more influential upon the shaping of man. His genetic makeup, his heredity, or his environment. And that's been fought over as long as I can remember. I think I even debated on this in high school one time, I don't know. But it's been around for a long time. And now both are accepted as being, what did I say, when I was in high school, and it's been around a long time. Okay, it was a long time ago when I was in high school. But anyway, now it's kind of accepted that both are equally influential upon the development of man. The scientist would work more in the genetic field, the educator more in the environmental field. And again, hear me, I am not saying that our modern educators, especially the great names in education, have not accomplished anything good. They have accomplished much good. But once more, we cannot put a stamp of approval as Christians upon everything they've done. Both Dewey and Skinner, perhaps the two most prominent names in education, have made statements to the effect that home is not the place to raise children. The children must be raised by those who are specially trained to control their environment. This whole matter of values clarification in school, you know, it's not the teaching of values. It's the values clarification, where each child must clarify his own values. This whole matter of behavior modification has an awful lot in it that has to do with controlled environment, shaping the child into what the controller has in mind. Now, the philosophy that governs it has the name humanism. It's a long time getting around to that name. But the philosophy that governs all these practices, that man must solve his own problems, that he is the key to his own existence, there is none other, is known as humanism. A definition of humanism is simply that man is the highest good. He is the measure of all things. And it's been around a long time, ever since the creation, or shortly thereafter, when Satan suggested to Eve, "Ye shall be as God." But it was never written formally. There was much writing, much humanistic writing among the ancient philosophers, but never really set down formally that this is what humanism is until 1933, which is comparatively late in world history. And then the Humanist Manifesto was produced. And I don't know if you're acquainted with the first Humanist Manifesto or not. Some interesting things about it. One is that it refers continually to the religion of humanism. The second Humanist Manifesto, in 1973, no longer speaks of the religion of humanism or religious humanism. It just says humanism. But just to read a few excerpts, in case you're not acquainted with it, 1933, humanism is philosophical, religious, and moral, and as old as civilization itself. The starting point of humanism is the preservation and enhancement of all things human. Now, some of the principles. Religions the world over are under the necessity of coming to terms with new conditions created by vastly increased knowledge. We therefore affirm the following. The universe is self-existing and was not created. Man has emerged as the result of a continuing process. The nature of the universe depicted by modern science makes unacceptable any supernatural or cosmic guarantees of human value. Religion consists of those actions, purposes, and experiences which are humanly significant. The complete realization of the human personality is the goal of man's life. No uniquely religious emotion of the kind hitherto associated with belief in the supernatural should be had. And though we consider the religious forms and ideas of our fathers no longer adequate, man is at last becoming aware that he alone is responsible for the realization of the world of his dreams, and he has within himself the power to achieve it. Of course, one of the leading signers there was John Dewey. Then came the second Humanist Manifesto of 1973, in which it points out that, in its introduction, that in 33, humanists still believed in a kind of traditional theism. especially a prayer-hearing God, assume to love and care for people, to hear and understand their prayers and do something about them. But that is now an outmoded faith. The next century should be and can be the humanistic century. We believe that traditional dogmatic authoritative religions that place God, revelation, ritual, or creed above human needs do a disservice. We find insufficient evidence for belief in the existence of the supernatural. And if there is such, it is meaningless and irrelevant. Traditional religions often offer solace to humans, but they inhibit humans from helping themselves or experiencing their full potentiality. We can discover no divine purpose or providence for the human species. No deity will save us, we must save ourselves. Science affirms that the human species is an emergence from natural evolutionary forces. Ethics is autonomous and situational. The right to birth control, abortion, and divorce should be recognized. Sexual behavior between consenting adults and the many varieties of sexual exploration should never be considered evil. Individuals should be permitted to express their sexual proclivities and pursue their lifestyles as they desire. Civil liberties include the recognition of the individual's right to die with dignity, euthanasia, and the right to suicide. Well, it goes on that everybody should have a guaranteed annual income, and that the it's imperative that there be a world law and a world order all under one head. And finally, technology is the vital key to human progress and development. We resist any moves that are moral, political, or social that would bar scientific research. So, and of course, among the signers there, the lead one, the most important one is B.F. Skinner. So Skinner, together with Dewey, are the fathers of present-day education. So these are the two humanist manifestos, the first real statements of what humanism is. And among the signers are not only these two renowned educators, but you go down the line and it's the heads of the educational schools at various universities, university presidents, and so on, are all very prominent in the field of education. Humanism, of course, permeates every facet of life, the entertainment industry, the whole idea of putting down traditional values and morals is a humanistic expression. The music of the day, which stresses the importance of doing your own thing, of living life for this present moment with no thought for tomorrow. The social life today, which encourages choosing your own lifestyle, whatever enhances your own happiness, is right. Religion, humanism enters into religion when you have the tremendous stress upon the experiential, that how your feelings and what you have experienced becomes really the highlight of your religious faith. Psychiatry, the whole matter of self-actualization, of acting out who you are, first discovering who you are and acting it out, but mostly in education is where humanism shows up. There is one textbook being used in public schools, and I can't document this, I wish I could, but I was told by someone who should know that the textbook was developed by funds from HEW. That I don't know for sure. But anyway, a textbook that is being used, for example, has changed Lincoln's Gettysburg Address to make it humanistic. We're acquainted with Madeline Murray O'Hare's attempts to get in God We Trust removed from the coins, which wouldn't really bother me too much anyway, but were taken off. It's only the principle upon which she's arguing that bothers me. But Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, as it is printed in a public school textbook, has omitted the words under God, where he says, "This nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom." It reads in a textbook, "This nation shall have a new birth of freedom." And not only that, but it is dishonest. There are no marks to show omission of words. So this is how humanism can insinuate itself into various areas of life. Now, why is it so popular? Well, there are several reasons. I think that the serious scientist and the serious educator
feels that he has a responsibility because of his training and because of his position of leadership and influence to do everything he can to improve life. And I think he falls into humanism as his tools. This is what he has to work with, his people. And so I think some very serious people drift into this without intending to. For society, I think humanism is popular for society at large because it emphasizes the present. And in a society that has been called a Me Too generation, in which self-gratification is put on a pedestal, and regardless of what the cost is, you know, fly now, pay later, you only go around once in life, live it with all the gusto you can. In this kind of society, humanism stresses living for the moment. No responsibility beyond the moment. And for too many in our society, I think the appeal of humanism is that it does relieve them of responsibility. Because what I do, even if it's an evil deed, can't be blamed on me, it's my genes. And it's the society in which I live that surrounds me. That's what shaped me into what I am, see? Society and my genes. And so when you hear statements like, this person or that person didn't kill Robert Kennedy or Martin Luther King, we all did. This is pure and simple humanism. The escape of responsibility by the individual. And he is a product of forces beyond his control, so he has no responsibility. The evidence of the fallen state of man. Now, what do humanists see as an obstacle? You know, the Humanist Manifesto says that it can be and should be the religion of this century. And humanists are quite free to admit that the biggest obstacle to it becoming the religion of the century is the Judeo-Christian tradition. And that's why you will find humanists like Madeline Murray and others level such bitter attacks against Christianity. It's the thing that stands in their way. And with Christianity's affirmation that God is a creator and that man is responsible to God for what he does with this creation, with its emphasis upon God as being an overruling providence who will allow things to go only so far before he steps in. You know, as the psalmist says, that he that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. With the Christian emphasis upon God providing a deliverer in whom all things are tied together and really make sense, and a destiny for man beyond his few short years on earth. With these emphasis, the Christian tradition stands in the way of humanism. And so you have these virile attacks upon Christianity, particularly upon Bible-based Christianity. The closer it is to the Bible, the stronger the attack. And you have organizations, not only Mad Mary O'Hare's American Association of Atheists, but you have the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Freedom From Religion Foundation, which has published bitter attacks on the Ten Commandments, on the moral law, as being having no part in our day, and not speaking to man at all today. And, unfortunately, in some of its resolutions, the National Organization of Women. Now, has shown itself to be extremely humanistic. And there will be more. I think we're seeing only the beginning, and that's why this was entitled Humanism, the Religion of the Future. Humanists fully intend to make their philosophy the religion of today and tomorrow. It is a religion. It's a religion that declares to man, you shall be as God. And Walter Kaufman, an educator who is a humanist, says that's one of the most beautiful sayings there was. That is man's charter of freedom. You shall be as gods. It's a religion that prides itself in the principle of Babel. Now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. It's a religion that says what the wicked citizens said in the Lord's parable about the nobleman who went away and came back. This nobleman representing God. And the people said, we will not have this man rule over us. That's the religion of humanism. Now we should make a distinction. I have simply spoken of humanism. All along, I was speaking of secular humanism. Because I believe there is a kind of humanism that is vital and valid, and that is Christian humanism. I believe that Christians are the only true humanists there are, because Christians place a value upon human life that is far beyond the combination of cells that make up the being. They place a value on a life that cannot contribute to society, on a life that is yet unborn, on a life that is aged and perhaps in a coma, on a life where the mind is completely shattered. The true humanist values that life as much as any other because of the price that God paid, the blood of his son, to redeem that life. I can't see any true humanism outside of that value. That value which makes those who accept the Son of God a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people of infinite worth. Christians are humanists who know that man cannot subsist on his own flesh, but his life is from God and he is responsible to God, not only for that life, but for the life of everyone. To stem the tide of secular humanism, we must do more than just harangue against it. I think that Christians must, first of all, in their churches, on every possible occasion, affirm the ultimacy of God. And sing those words, glory to God in the highest, from hearts that are fully persuaded that they will give glory to God in the highest when they step outside the doors of their church. I think we must give our support to the best schools. And by that I mean the schools that know that man is more than just a collection of cells. Schools that educate the whole man, body, mind, and spirit. Why educate two-thirds of the man, as the humanists do? Why not minister to the whole man? I think we must, as Christians, know that we are redeemed for a purpose. And that we, as redeemed people, go to our daily tasks, whether they're in a classroom, or behind a counter, or on a construction job, or wherever it might be, that we do these things as the redeemed of God, and that this shows in our application to our job, into the trust that's been given us, that everything become a stewardship of what the Lord has provided. I think Christians must minister ever more to one another. Why is it that so often we turn to the world for aid when Christian people could be there as the covenant community ministering to one another? And I think we must affirm that the family is God's basic institution. His primary form of government, that we must rid our own homes of anything that would divide that home. Whether it means turning off television when Saturday Night Live comes on with a skit that is very destructive of the value that God has placed on families, or if it means throwing out certain books or magazines, I think we must hold the family up as God's institution and rid ourselves of anything that would divide the family. And we must fight against any legislation or any social movement or any entertainment media that supports alternative lifestyles to the family, or that denies the God-given distinction between the sexes. And then finally, I believe that we must rejoice. We must go about our daily tasks with a smile on our face and with confidence in our hearts, believing and rejoicing that God will have the ultimate victory over all those who deny His truth, that the world and all that it contains belongs to Him, who is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, who shall reign forever and ever. And with that, I'll close and ask now if there's some part of this that you would like to discuss, particularly if you have anything to contribute. This is, I will admit, my first attempt to present something on humanism. This is the emphasis that our commission, and I'll tell you a little bit about our commission after a while, but this is the emphasis that we're going to have all through next year is producing materials on humanism. Okay, well,
what's your response to humanity and thinking of people like John Bruce Hill and Rob Schull, who is an entire team? Now, you know, the enormous they have
there's a lot of difference between the two men in spite of the fact that one is a disciple of the other. In the first place, the big difference is that Schuller presents Christ much more than Peel, but not in the public broadcast or the public service. And many of the attended his institutes out there have said this, that privately and in his instruction classes, he is very Christ-centered, but he said people would turn him off on the air. Or in public service, they wouldn't come back. He has to get their attention first by starting where they are, not where he is. And then if he can get them into his instruction classes and so on, he can bring them to where he is. It's not a matter of subterfuge. It's a matter of strategy, of getting people to relate to him where they are, rather than seeing so far in it. So I think in that sense, Schuller would be much more Christ-centered. Peel, Power of Positive Thinking, I don't get much out of him, to tell you the truth. I think it's a nice humanistic message, really. But I think there is this, a humanistic message, but I think there is this, that he uses the kinds of words that people with a Christian background will understand him differently. They will read things into what he says, and he can be very beneficial because of the presuppositions of the hearers. But if the person came as a complete blank, without a knowledge of Christ, I don't think he would get it there. But it works. It helps people. And so did Cooley. You know, the man in the last century who said all human problems could be solved by getting up every morning and saying in every day and every way, I'm getting better and better, and really believing it? It worked. It actually healed people of diseases and all sorts of things. But the fact that something works doesn't always mean that it's valid.
It seems to the way of science, in the lesson today, that
joined together in opposition to something else may not at all be whether politics makes strange bedfellows or something like that. And I think that's how Moon, for example, got his first attention. Was he was so anti-communist that people all wanted to be associated with him at the beginning, because he was a man fighting communism. See? And so he was attracting people who were as far from him as they were from communism. So I think you're right there, yeah. Very positive thinking. Yeah. No, Reverend Ike, to me, I don't know whether to consider him a charlatan. I don't think so. He's honest. He tells people he's out to rip them up if he can. You know?
He's honest.
Yeah. and he makes a game of it. And I think a lot of people see a lot of humor in what he's doing, and they feel friendly to the guy because he's so open and friendly about it. But I don't know, really don't know if you put him. He's in a class by himself. Yeah. But he has helped a tremendous number of people.
Yeah, but it's through positive.
Through positive thinking, sure.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. You know, when I left Oklahoma, the Ministerial Alliance gave me a little book. You know, they always give a memento to whoever was moving away. And for the life of me, I don't know whether they meant to help me or judge me. The book was titled, How to Be a Transformed Person. I don't know if it was a suggestion but it was one of the same things. It wasn't P.O., but it was a book very similar. It purported to be religion, but you can nowhere identify it as Christian. Okay. Yes, 1933 to 1973.
And these things you read, they were all manifest.
Yes, I was reading right from it. But I was skipping very rapidly, just the things I had underlined.
Well, then this one called for their humanist type
of
belief.
This is the group of people down here. Yeah, right.
And they
sent it. In a symposium, this was produced. Yeah, the history is given too in the introduction.
I never knew that they had
gotten
together, and you're saying that these people
that
are all
in
one mind and support.
Yeah, yeah, it is signed, and then the publisher makes it possible for anyone to have their signature to send it in. And so these were only the original signers. There have been many more names appended since then. Betty Friedan and all sorts of people who are very much in the news.
Okay. Those of us who have sons and daughters
who are in college or already in college and came to
the
United States, how do you handle the fact that you do need to expose to
the
community concept,
whether they came from a Christian
environment
or not?
The only thing I know of is that in your own home, in your own dealing with those around your own children, you know, in the church, is simply to prepare them for the idea that this exists. You know, so there's an appeal in something new that they're exposed to the first time. Whereas if they're aware of it ahead of time, and then show that the chief flaw of it is that it does not minister to the whole man. It does not take the whole man into consideration. And in a sense, you could call it unscientific for that reason. That it's only concerned with man's body and mind. And, not his soul at all. So, it's an extremely difficult thing, but I think the reason that so many kids have problems when they get into college is that they were not aware that they grew up in a rather sheltered environment. And by sheltered here, I mean a sheltered spiritual environment. And it just strikes them as something new. It's, and you know, they're right at that age when if they can take a few cracks at the old man, rebel him somehow and show that they know more than he does and cast off the old values, they'll seize upon any opportunity, and this will just be another opportunity. Whereas if our people can show that they know all about this already, that it's old hat, and has been old hat for centuries, it may lose some of its glitter. I think that's what's so important. You know, I mentioned before, please hear me when I say there is no conflict with science. I honestly believe this. That there is no conflict whatsoever between Christianity and science. But when I'm talking about science, I'm talking about that which is able to be proven and reproduced in the laboratory, not somebody's ideas. You know?
So here again, they had what you said, that's what you said yesterday, that's how these young women who actually meet someone like that, you know, who knows if this change.
Mm-hmm.
They will go in there and they will, like you said, take on this father mother image.
Yeah.
And say, well, look, you know, I'm really explaining this to you, you know, help me out.
Mm-hmm.
If that can be done in the home and in the church, I think you can cut off a lot of that.
Yeah. One of my hobbies for years was reading and studying about biblical archaeology. And it was there that I really learned to know just how little conflict there is between science and scripture. Where, for example, I think it mentioned that as of the year 1900, there were 42 kings mentioned in the books of Kings and Chronicles, kings of Israel and their neighbors, that no written record had ever been found of. The only record was in the Bible for 42 different people in the year 1900. The only record. And so they were relegated by the those who attacked the Bible into the realm of mythology. By 1933, every one of them had been confirmed by some evidence that had been uncovered. A burial marker somewhere, a foundation of a building, a clay tablet. But every one of those 42 was resurrected in those 33 years from 1900 to 1933. The scientific archaeology has nothing to fear. The biblical scholar has nothing to fear from the really scientific archaeologist. You know, when Jesus, when the disciples came out of the temple, they looked at all these beautiful buildings and so on, and we were talking about the temple, and one of those things, at that time, the people came and asked him to have his disciples keep quiet. They were going around witnessing too much. And then he said, at that time, that if these were silent, the stones of the earth would cry out. And they've been crying out ever since, in confirmation of the biblical message. Every time an archaeologist shovel turns over something, it can be a new evidence, or at least a new explanation, an illumination of the biblical text, what it means. Now that's not the subject of humanism, but it's simply to strengthen this belief of mine that there is no conflict between science and the Bible. There's some conflict between some applications of science and the moral code of the Bible. But that was that. Okay? Scientific research whatsoever.
Well, I'm thinking in terms of saying, like, you know, a person can lose it all at
one
time, and through medical science, in many cases, they can go back home.
Right.
You know, all things
lose
it all.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to use it like that to say, and things like that, where many persons would leave children in prayer by faith.
There may be a conflict. I don't see that there would have to be. I think any doctor, even an atheist doctor, will tell you that the body, in many cases, heals itself. But most healing is really the body healing itself. Much medicine is simply removing the obstacles to the body healing itself. And if you really thought of it, doctors, I've talked to doctors about this, their estimates run from a minimum of 50% to a maximum of 90% of our illnesses are in our mind and their physical symptoms. 50 to 90%.
So let's take the low figure, 50%. Nearly all doctors will agree that at least 25% of our illnesses are the body heals itself. Now put those two together, and you get 75%. That's the guarantee that a faith healer has when he begins. He's assured of 75% rate of success.
Yes, though, Jesus, understanding of the Bible that you might believe, I think that the Bible says that Jesus is our heaven, and heals and raises and gives life back to the Father. I think this actually, by faith I think this actually counts as a blessing.
Yes, I do too.
In reality, I don't believe the gospel of miracles.
No, I believe in miracles today.
I know that he does not go away to glorify a man or some leader to become an outstanding
person. Right. I believe very strongly in miracles, and I believe they come as an answer to prayer. Mm-hmm. But I believe that my prayer in Jesus' name is as valid as the next man's. Mm-hmm. That it's not vested in some particular human being that is glorified.
Okay.
This is what we're trying to develop this year. That's our emphasis. Now, let me tell you about our commission. Very quickly, in a couple sentences. Our commission is established by the Lutheran Church in its headquarters building for providing information and counsel to people who have questions or who are troubled by some organization that's involved in religion, generally not a church. We work with Positive. We work with the campus fraternities, sororities, Boy Scouts. You know, there's a little bit of religion there in the Scout Earth. And then the Scout Promise and so on. Any organization, not generally a church, that has anything at all to do with religion, we're the repository for information and supposedly counsel. And so there are very extensive files on all kinds of religious organizations. And we have certain materials that we try to prepare for what's current, like now with the new religions. But in 1980, our emphasis will be upon humanism and humanistic organizations, and that's what we'll be developing materials on, particularly study materials. Our office is 500 North Broadway, 63102, Lutheran Church. That's all it takes. Sometimes people just put Lutheran Church St. Louis, it gets there. But it's better if it's got 500 North Broadway. We get all kinds of things we don't ask for. You talk about prophecy. For 7 straight weeks now, we have gotten a warning. And for the life of me, I forgot the year. It's probably more important than the date, but it's May 29th. I know that's when the world's coming to an end. It's May 29th. I think it's 1982. But 7 straight weeks, every week I get a letter. You know, warning number 1, warning number 2, warning number 3, we're up to warning number 7 now. And it's by a man by the name of Shlamiel or something, number 777. We have also heard from number 666, number 888, number 333. 333 wants to be a Nobel Prize winner, and he wants us to nominate him. So, we get all kinds of men.
We're going to take a short break now.